Father, I just want to thank you so much for the opportunity to be here together today. And I thank you that this is the Sunday before Christmas, and we can focus in on your coming. We just thank you for all that you've done for us, and particularly as we think this time of year about how you came and gave your life for us. So I pray you bless the time in your word this morning, that you just really help to continue teaching us through the Apostle Paul's words in Galatians. We just thank you for that. In Jesus' name, amen. So we are at Galatians chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the day set by the father. So also we, while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. As you can see, this is sort of a continuation of the Apostle Paul's illustration about a child in Roman times and how he was under guardians, some versions translated tutors, until the time that was set by his father for him to become an adult. Now, in Jewish culture, that would happen when the Jewish boy turned 13 and they had a bar mitzvah. And that was his time of becoming a man. In Roman culture, they had a similar thing, which is more what Paul is referring to here, where between 16 and 18, time set by the father to determine that he would actually become an adult. And until that time, he was in the household, but he was as a child under guardians the whole time. Paul is writing here mainly to Gentiles, who would have been familiar with the Roman culture of the time. And so they would have really related to this. They would have understood what he was saying. But the Jews would have understood also, because they had something similar. They just called it a different thing, and it happened at a different time. In the Jewish ceremony, the bar mitzvah ceremony, when the young boy of 13 became a man, the father would pray a prayer, and he would say, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, Oh God, thank you for relieving me of the responsibility for this young man. And the young man would pray, you know, Oh God, thank you for giving me the responsibility of manhood or something. I think it's really neat that there is, at this time of Christmas, that there is a hidden treasure in Galatians 4 that is kind of an unexpected Christmas message in here. Before we get to the verses that are the hidden Christmas message in Galatians 4, we see the Apostle Paul finishing his illustration of the child in Roman society who would become a legal adult. And he kind of gives us a before and after picture. And he did this in the previous verses. Remember, he gave us kind of a before picture. Before faith came is how it was worded in chapter 3. This is what we were like. But then when faith came, here's what we got to be like. Well, he does the same thing here. In a way, and I'll show you next week, the arguments that he gives in chapter 3 are almost exactly paralleled by these arguments here in chapter 4. But we'll focus on that more next week. Starts off and he says, Now I say. He's kind of emphasizing that he's making a little transition here. He's just finished up the things in chapter 3 where he talked about the law having become our tutor or our guardian that leads us to Christ. But now that faith has come, we're no longer under that guardian. And he kind of illustrates or punctuates his point here, I guess, when he says, Now, I say to you, he's saying, as long as the heir is a child, and by the way, that word for child is the Greek word nepios. It's a child who does not have understanding. A very, very small child. But notice he says he is the heir. He's definitely the heir. He's the son. As long as the heir is a nepios, he does not differ at all from a slave. If you think about that Roman culture of the day, a Roman child would be born into the world, and he would be an infant, and he would grow up in that household, and he is the heir. And someday he will be the owner of everything, as it says in this verse. But until that time, he is treated no differently than even a slave in that household. He has no rights, basically. He has to do what he's told. He's constantly under supervision. And so Paul's point here is kind of interesting. Even though he's the rightful heir, you might say the prince of the house, he's not treated any differently from a slave until he reaches that age set by the father. So Paul develops this whole illustration of the child that becomes a legal adult. And even though the child is going to be the heir and he's going to be the owner of all the riches of his whole family, before that time, it's the before picture here, before that time when he's legally an adult, there really isn't any difference between him and the lowliest slave in that household. He does not differ at all from a slave, although he is owner of everything. The word owner there is the word kurios, which is Lord. Isn't that interesting? So it really almost does speak of a picture of how this is the little king who is growing up in the house, but he's growing up as a slave, no different than a slave, even though he's going to be the king of everything, the Lord, the one who controls everything. But he's under guardians and managers until the day set by the Father. In the last chapter, in chapter 3, we saw he used a word, paidagogos, which was child conductor or tutor, they translated here, guardian. Here he uses two different words also. The word for guardian and manager, those are two different words, not paidagogos, but other ones. For instance, manager is oikonomos. Sounds like economist, doesn't it? And it means a household manager. And typically there might have been a trusted slave who was the household manager and kept care of all the accounts and was the overseer of the other slaves and so on. I think Paul is not trying to make a distinction here between, well, he's a paidagogos or he's an oikonomos or he's a, some other kind of thing. He's just trying to be complete. He's showing you the full range of possibilities. Now, this child is definitely under the control of all kinds of different people in this household until, there's the word until again, and we saw that word in chapter 3 in his previous analogy. It points to the fact that it's just temporary. There's going to be an until, and when that until comes, then it's going to be different. So in verses 1 and 2 of Galatians chapter 4, Paul just kind of extends that illustration of the child in the Roman household. Now in verse 3, he says, here's where he makes the point. So also we. Here's where he applies his illustration of a little baby or child growing up in the Roman household to us. So also we. While we were children, and again the word is nepioi, while we were children. What does he mean, while we were children? Are we children in the Roman household? And it's like, no. The illustration has to be applied to us in the sense of there was a time before which we were considered and treated by God as immature children who had to be constantly watched and told when they were wrong and corrected and led by the hand and taken here and there, maybe made to do things they didn't want to do. Well, that's the sense in which we were under the law. Remember, the law is like a sin meter or a sin alarm system. And every time you put your big hairy toe across the line, it goes wrong, 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 wrong. Well, that's what he's alluding to again. He's saying, we were children. We were held in bondage. Again, that gives the picture that he painted in chapter 3 of like being in prison almost, with a guard outside the door. And we were in bondage to our own nature because of the fact that Adam and Eve disobeyed God, and God brought a curse upon them for that. It changed the way we are. And so even the good in us is twisted to a point where there's not really anything we can do that is really good in God's eyes. And we come that way. We're in bondage to that. There's no escape from that. It's like that word that we saw in chapter 3 where God said we are shut up to sin. We're closed off on all sides. We're surrounded by the enemy and there's really no way out. There's nothing we ourselves can do to get ourselves out of that. So we're in bondage. And he says an interesting phrase here at the end of chapter 4, verse 3. Under the elemental things of the world. Why didn't he say under the law? Because that's what he's been saying before. You know, you're in bondage under the law. The law watches over you. The law squawks when you make the least wrong move. But he didn't. He said the elemental things of the world. And this is kind of interesting because, again, I think he broadens the scope of things. If he would just say the law, the law, the law, then these Gentiles who are listening to him might say, oh, he's just talking to the Jews. We're not, you know, born under the law. So he must not be talking to us. No, he's talking to them too because he broadens it out. He says the elemental things of the world. Elemental things is the word stoicheia. And that was used for foundations. It was used to describe the rudiments of something, the elementary things. It was even used to describe the ABCs of language. So when you see elemental things, you can almost say, well, these are like the foundational or common principles that are common not just to the Jews, but to all the Gentiles as well. And I think what he's saying here, he can include the Jewish law in these elemental things. But I think it also broadens this idea to include Gentile laws. Even the Gentiles had laws and codes. In archaeology, that Hammurabi, one of the famous kings of old, had a code of law that they discovered. It was a written code. And it was actually, in some ways, very similar to the Jewish law. But it had rules for what to do if a person should commit murder or, you know, all kinds of different legal situations. Gentiles even had their own laws. There's also cultural rituals, even pagan rituals that Gentiles lived under. And that's included in this word, elemental things. The Jewish law might be the A of ABCs. The Code of Hammurabi might be B. Gentile pagan rituals might be C, and you know, you can just piece together a lot of different things that could be included in this word, elemental things. Even common sense. We're all born with a conscience. I think that's included in here. Folk wisdom, different things that have been passed down from generation to generation. Any kind of man-made religious system would be included under here as well. Some people worshipped the gods that they saw in different constellations and the stars and so forth. And that could be included in here as well. I think he's trying to paint a pretty broad picture when he uses that phrase. So what is it that we're under bondage to? It's even broader than the Jewish law. It's all kinds of laws and rules and regs that we could consider all those things that say you're wrong. Not just the Jewish law, but other laws as well. And that keeps us in bondage. It points out how sinful we really are and how much we need somebody to come rescue us. So when he says in Galatians 4, verse 3, so we also, he's making the illustration apply to us, that we were children in bondage under all kinds of different things. And it's a real life analogy that he's making connections with the people he's writing to. You guys have these things in your life. It makes a connection with us too, doesn't it? Because we all do too. We have things in our life that we're in bondage to. Things that point out exactly all the flaws in our character and in our behavior. Mankind has been held in bondage under these kinds of things until the appointed time set by God. And that is where Galatians 4, verse 4 comes into the picture. He's painted this before picture of what it was like before that point in time in history. And now in verse 4 he says, but, which is a word of contrast, right? This is what it was like before. But, when that until point came, after that, when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law. So here Paul tells us exactly when that appointed time was that God had determined. And it was a moment when all the preparations that God had been making throughout all of human history, ever since the fall, when Adam and Eve sinned, and our nature became twisted, and at that point there was no hope for us. All these thousands of years since then, mankind has been living in hopelessness in that sense. The only hope has been faith in God. But even the Old Testament saints who had faith died without seeing that point in time when God was going to provide the rescuer who would come in, deliver us from that tragedy. So Paul tells us exactly when this moment is. God set in motion a chain of events here with the birth of his son in a stable in Bethlehem. So as it says in your notes, this is the Christmas story in a nutshell. This is it. When the fullness of time came, God sent his son to be born of a woman, born as a Jew under the law. And I think it's kind of interesting when you think about it. On that very first Christmas, when Jesus came into the world, the time was perfect for Jesus to come into the world. It was the fullness of time, the exact right moment for God to send Christ was at that very time. And there's a lot of things that you could think of that might indicate that. I just jotted down a couple of thoughts here. One was the time was right religiously. The religious climate of the day. The Jews, first of all, they had completed what's called the canon, or the completed text of the Old Testament. They had accepted, all of them had agreed that these books of the Old Testament are indeed our scriptures, and they formed them into the Old Testament. That had not happened before this particular time. That was something that really needed to be done. The Old Testament needed to be verified, and these books and no more are the Old Testament scriptures. So they've completed the Old Testament canon. Another thing that happened is when they were dragged off to captivity in Babylon, they didn't have their temple. So they developed a system of meetings or assemblies. They called them the synagogue. They had these synagogues everywhere. Really, everywhere there were a group of just a few families of Jews, they would have a synagogue. And these synagogues were for worship, but they were also schools and courts, which is really interesting. You can see that there's a pattern here for what the church would become later. But they developed a synagogue system that hadn't happened until just previous to when Jesus came. Both of these things would really help in the furthering of spreading the gospel, of good news of Christ. Another thing is the time was right culturally. The whole culture of that day was really affected by Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had taken what at that time the whole known world was just little pockets of kings and warlords. Alexander the Great conquered the whole part of the known world there. He spread Greek culture and, more importantly, Greek language. There was a common language that the whole world spoke, really the whole known world of that time. They were forced to speak it because they were a conquered people. So not only did they have a common culture, and that the Greek culture with philosophy and mathematics and all kinds of other things were spread to these different peoples, but they also began to speak a common language, what's called Common Greek or Koine Greek. And guess what the New Testament is written in? Koine Greek. Because everybody knew it. Also, when the Romans came over, they conquered the territory that Alexander the Great had previously conquered. They basically took it over. And they didn't change a lot of things. They saw the advantage of keeping a lot of the things the same that Alexander the Great had instituted. What they did do, though, is they were builders. And they built roads. and they built aqueducts, and they built theaters, and they built cities and governments. They instituted a legal system that provided for peace. And also, if you were a Roman citizen, it was like being a citizen of the United States of America. It was basically a free area, and going from place to place was common. And that was the way it was back in the Pax Romana, they call it, the Roman peace. It was a time of, you know, relative peace because they enforced it with their armies. But there were roads that made travel easy and common. It was very common for people to go from place to place. The shipping lanes and so forth were available for people to travel great distances in a short time. So culturally and politically, it was the right time for Christ to come into the world. Once the gospel, the good news of what Christ was going to do for us, needed to be shared, it would be easy to get it out to all the known world at that whole time. So the time was right religiously, culturally, and politically with the Pax Romana, and economically too, with the roads, travel, relatively safe and easy passage from one place to another. So, the fullness of time, that first Christmas, came at exactly the right moment in human history. It was exactly the right moment that God had planned ahead of time. The thing I think is also interesting is that this particular verse doesn't stop here. There's another clause that extends into verse 5 that tells us something really important about that fullness of time, that moment when Christ came. And it says, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that. This is a purpose clause. And there's a special word in the Greek language that indicates that this is the purpose for Christ's coming, God sending his Son. In order that. Why did Christ come? In order that he might redeem those who were under the law. Or you could say, who were under the elemental things of the world. Not just the Jewish law, but all of the laws and rules and regs and the system of bondage that we have been under for generations. That he might redeem those who were under the law. And the word for redeem is the word we saw previously. Ex agorazo. Out of the agora. To buy out of the slave market. To purchase out of the slave market. We talked about that previously. God had a purpose. There was a moment in history that was just the right time for Jesus to come for many, many reasons. But his purpose was that Jesus might purchase us, buy our freedom from that slavery. And those who were under the law, again, implies back to the previous illustration that we were imprisoned, that we were under guards, that we were slaves and not free, and there was nothing we could do about it. There was no way of escape on our own. Here comes the hero. Exactly the right moment in history. He came to redeem those who were under the law. And there's another additional purpose that's expressed in the very last phrase, that we might receive the adoption as sons. You are all sons. Remember, we said the word was huios, which was fully mature adult, legal adult sons in the Roman Empire. Well, the word here is huiothesion, which indicates a formal process of taking someone who was not your natural son and making them your son by adoption. And we used the example of Ben-Hur, the movie Ben-Hur last week. And there's a point in there where Ben-Hur, who's a galley slave on a warship, saves his commander's life. The commander goes back in victory to Rome and is honored by Caesar, becomes very powerful, and he has no natural son of his own. So he has no one to pass on all of his glory to. And so, because Ben-Hur had saved his life, he takes him from a slave to a person who is in his household. And then there's a point in time when he announces in front of all the people there, I am now making Ben-Hur my son. He's becoming Arius. He's going to take my name. And he's now young Arius. And the older Arius takes off his ring with his family seal and gives it to Ben-Hur and puts it on his hand, meaning that he now is not only the heir, but he has become the Lord of everything. He has now made that transition. So this word was used, huiathesios, was literally placing in sonship. And it was a legal term, the act of giving the status of sonship to someone who was not a natural child. So this was a common custom. It was an honored custom in that day. And it gave someone special dignity and family membership to a person who was not really born into that family. Another movie that we rented when we rented Ben-Hur last week was Stuart Little. And I thought of Stuart Little. That family had some really neat traditions, didn't they? They were Littles, and there was something that defined them. Even when they came in the door to greet each other, little hi, little ho, and there was a responding greeting. And you were a little, you were special. Well, Stuart was not born in that family. But there was a point in time when they went to the orphanage and they adopted him. And he became a huiathesios in their family. He was not a natural child, but he was granted all the privileges of family membership. And he got to participate in being a little. And being a little defined him. There were times in the second movie when he got into some trouble. And how did he get out? By remembering that littles never give up. Well, he was a little by adoption. He persevered and he repaired that little airplane and he flew it back home. And I just happen to think of that as another illustration of what this word means. It's taking somebody that's not your natural son and making them a son by adoption with all the rights and privileges. And that's exactly what God did for us. We are not naturally children of His, are we? By nature, we are children of wrath. And God, by placing us into His family, when we exercise our faith in what Christ did for us, He makes us adopted sons. I think it's especially interesting in light of the fact that, Vicki, you were adopted. So we have an adopted person sitting right here with us who knows exactly what that's like. And it's a really special thing. And you were just adopted into a human family. But to be adopted into God's household, how incredible that is, with all the riches and glory that He has then becoming available to us. That is phenomenal. So, verses 4 and 5 tell us that Jesus Christ was sent at exactly the right moment into this world to live a godly life as a good Jew. But, more importantly, the purpose that He came was to pay that price of redemption so that He could buy us out of the bondage that we're in, buy us out of the slave market by His death on the cross. He had to pay that price. We were all imprisoned under various laws. The Jewish law, Gentile laws, the laws of our own nature. And there was nothing that we could really do to help ourselves. So He had to come and do it for us. I read in one place that in Roman culture, a slave could be redeemed and become a free person. Even a slave. Even the lowliest and worst slave could be redeemed and could become a free person. And that would be wonderful. But beyond that, they were also then eligible to receive adoption into some Roman family. So this verse tells us that God did both of those things. He didn't just redeem us, which would have been wonderful enough. He went beyond that. He went beyond the call of duty. He didn't just redeem us. He actually adopted us as sons, which is a phenomenal thing to think about. So, as it says in your notes, as we celebrate the coming of the Son of God in Christmas, at this Christmas season, we need to remember that it was right at the fullness of time, the perfect moment, that He did this. Actually, I think what Paul is getting at here is, I think he's talking about the change from one dispensation to another in human history. This is a dispensational turning point. The Old Testament period of the Mosaic Law and the Jewish nation, there's something that changed at the fullness of time when God sent His Son into the world and Christ died on the cross to purchase us out of the slave market. Then a new way of working with mankind began. And so there's a transition in human history. One dispensation or way of working with mankind has now ended, and a new dispensation, or God's way of working with mankind in a new way, has started when God, at the fullness of time, sent His Son. And we are now living under that new dispensation. That doesn't last forever either. There's going to be a time when that dispensation will end, and there will be another new way of God working. The Lord Jesus Christ comes to claim His earthly kingdom and to rule on the throne of His father David. And that may be very soon. So, as it says in your notes here, let's be more joyful and more grateful this Christmas season as we remember the purpose for Jesus' coming and the ultimate gift that He gave to us. Not only real freedom from the slave market, but even beyond that, adoption into His own family, His own household.